people that I noticed across the organization who either were in positions of power and sponsored folks, or people who were being sponsored by various folks. And the way their careers moved over the years, I think, was directly influenced by that, along with them having mentors that they could actually turn to and say, I'm struggling with this, how can I help? I had folks that I could talk to, but I think there was a ceiling as to how much I was going to be able to get out of them before it formed into a true mentorship type of relationship.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Kevin Stewart is an engineering leader who's worked across multiple company stages. Today, he's the VP of Engineering at Harvest. He's also been at Fastly, Heptio, NodeSource, and Adobe. In this episode, we talk about code switching. Kevin talks about the invisible burden that code switching puts on underrepresented groups. We use this as an opportunity to discuss building D&I initiatives that actually lead to greater inclusion on our teams. Right now, we're in a challenging period for engineering leaders. That's why I'm dedicating time to answer questions about engineering leadership. If you have questions about building and managing newly remote teams or anything else, email me at wes@woventeams.com and I'll try to help. Again, that's wes@woventeams.com. And now, here's my conversation with Kevin Stewart. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams. Could you share kind of a Cliff's Notes version of your experience at Adobe and what it taught you about career advancement?
Sure. So I joined Adobe towards the end of 2004 and came in as an engineering manager on their shared technologies team. And it started from a position of me working at a lot of startups previously and wanting to learn how do you build software at a large software company, and thought that that would be a great experience at Adobe for me to figure that out. What I initially learned was that they do it pretty much like everybody else, sometimes good, sometimes not so good. And they have all the same problems and challenges, usually around communication and expectation setting. So started off as an engineering manager, working primarily on the installers for the Creative Suite. I eventually moved up towards senior engineering manager after working on some shared services, sort of like Adobe's version of Amazon Web Services. And that transitioned into what eventually became Creative Cloud. And throughout that entire journey, I think I had mastered the art of just managing down, sort of growing my team, working with the folks that were actually doing the work, addressing their needs. Where I wasn't getting a lot of support or help or guidance was really managing across with my peers and managing up to executives. So I kind of learned through a lot of trial and error, a lot of just bumping my head against various walls and sort of seeing, well, that didn't have the result I thought it would have. Let's try something else. And for a while, it was frustrating until I just sort of learned, like, okay, this is going to be the process. I'm just going to have to muddle my way through a lot of these things, even as I sought out external folks to, you know, help me navigate some of these problems. And the things I learned were, one, if I had even had a little bit of help before I embarked on that particular journey, things might have changed drastically over time. And that adage about what got you there is not what's going to get you where you want to go next is actually very true. So I don't regret my time at Adobe. I learned a ton. It was a great company. But I think that my trajectory would have been very different had I had some of the mentorship and guidance that a lot of other folks had.
So you found that your peers maybe were, for whatever reason, having more mentorship, and you were kind of fumbling around in the dark. What do you think drove that change, that differential in mentorship maybe?
I think it's probably a combination of things, but I think the most important thing is just no one was willing to sponsor me. And you know, I'm using sponsor explicitly as opposed to mentorship, because mentorship would have helped in various areas of sort of teaching me some things that weren't in books, because frankly, there weren't even books like The Manager's Path or An Elegant Puzzle at the time that I was coming up. But really somebody who saw any potential in me and was like, I want to invest in this person. I think they will be a really strong executive at some point if I make sure that there are opportunities for him to prove that. And that makes all the difference. There were people that I noticed across the organization who either were in positions of power and sponsored folks, or people who were being sponsored by various folks. And the way their careers moved over the years, I think was directly influenced by that, along with them having mentors that they could actually turn to and say, I'm struggling with this. How can I help? I had folks that I could talk to, but I think there was a ceiling as to how much I was going to be able to get out of them before it formed into a true mentorship type of relationship.
So as define our terms, so mentorship versus sponsorship, how would you make that distinction?
I would say mentorship is very much akin to coaching. It's, you know, someone that you can turn to, present challenges, problems, and they can give you advice. Mentorship tends to be more towards advice, whereas sponsorship is really more about that person sticking their neck out for you, actually making opportunities available to you, and not necessarily telling you how to succeed in them, but making sure that there's a path to them and them being the one to say, I stand behind this person. I'm, you know, think that they're going to succeed in this area. And I think we should give them these opportunities. That to me is the biggest difference between mentorship and sponsorship.
So let's say I'm you've seen that lesson of the differential between sponsorship and not sponsorship. Have you been able to take that to any organizations you lead and, I don't know, maybe make sponsorship more explicit? Like, how can we make sure the right sponsorship is happening in our organizations?
Sure. I definitely have in some subsequent startups that I've gone to where my entire goal is to be a sponsor for folks. Like, it happened to me. I want to make sure that I'm actually able to sort of pay it forward and help someone else out. But I also do the mentorship aspect of it as well. So in subsequent organizations, there are folks that I saw that had potential to be great leaders or great senior engineers and just needed sort of the guidance to get there. A lot of what I would do is in my one-on-ones with them, talk to them about where they are, where they stand, what they're trying to accomplish in their careers, and explicitly lay out those paths for them. So for example, with one person who wanted to be a lead on a team, and they were still fairly early on their career, took our own coffee walks, talked about, here are some of the things that I need to see from you in order to put you in a lead position. I'm definitely going to put you in that role, but there's a delta between where you currently are and what I need to see you in there. And we started laying out, we're going to work on this project and this will give you this set of capabilities. Then I'm going to give you a set of projects and people to work with that will help build up these other capabilities. And that will lead towards a lead role. And even when that moved to the, what if I want to move over to engineering management? I said, well, the job is completely different. And here's, you know, what I would expect in that case. And I would totally support you in that role. This, interestingly, was an area where the whole diversity and inclusion thing came to play, where I could have easily promoted her to an engineering manager. And the discussion we actually had was that I don't want you to get promoted into a role because of your gender. Like, that's kind of the easy way out, that because everybody's so sensitive about D&I topics, me putting you into an engineering manager role would look great for me. It'd be like, look, I'm actually doing something about it. But I don't want you or anybody else to look at it as in any way undeserved. Like, let's go through the proper motions and make sure that no one can dispute your viability in that role and just say, oh, well, you just got it because you're a woman, or replace that with anybody else because you're Black or Puerto Rican or whatever. I always want to make sure that the foundation is laid, because I know there's going to be some folks out there that will look at people sideways and be like, how did they get in that position? Did they really earn it, or did they just get it because everyone's D&I crazy now?
Sounds like a tough balance to walk. On one side, like a world where we do that, we want to be certain because we know these people, someone might deserve the role, and we don't want them maligned by getting it for reasons that are not because they're, you know, a badass at the job. But if we make them go through too many hoops, right, that makes it harder on folks. How do you think about walking that line?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it definitely has to be balanced. And I can't say that there's a prescriptive way to do it in every situation, because everyone's a little bit different. But you want to make sure that there's at least some backing material to justify making a transition like that. There have been the cases where I see that somebody says, I want a promotion, and they immediately get it. And you can't look back. They're like, well, what have they done in their work history that says that they've been performing at a particular level or above a particular level? So I at least want to get some minimum level of, this person helped with this huge migration, or this person helped with this massive feature addition that we had to make to generate more revenue, or something compelling, meaty enough that it can stand on its own and say, you know, that alone or that and maybe these three other things are the justification for it. but I don't want it to turn into this, you know, okay, jump through this hoop and jump through this hoop and now cross this line. It's very easy to get into that mold. So you really want to set the expectations with the person up front saying, you know, this is not going to be a constantly, you know, moving goalpost for you. Like, here are the concrete things we want to achieve and be able to show. And then I'm willing to go fight that battle for you.
So we need to have tangible ways to document rather than just promoting everyone, but not have too many steps. Is that a fair summary of?
We have to be reasonable. I think that's what it really boils down to. It's too often when it's left to an individual just sort of making it up as they go along, then that's what leads to that sort of moving goalpost thing. So you really have to think about what's reasonable, but challenging. You can't just make things too easy. And then have that conversation with someone, make sure it's documented, and then actually lean into it. So a perfect example is recently at my time at Fastly, I had a director under me who was looking to get promoted to senior director. And with previous leaders, she felt that she wasn't getting a clear picture of what it would take for her to move up to that senior level, and to the point where she was almost thinking of leaving the company. So we had a conversation and I sat down with her and said, look, just from what little I've seen, it looks like you've done the work in a lot of different areas, but let me go check with the folks that would most likely be involved in your promotion, see what some of the objections are, see what we have to work on, and build up a plan and hope, you know, try to get you in a range that by the next promotion period comes around, you're going to get that promotion. And we sat down, we wrote it all out. She saw me put together the promotion packet and basically saw that I was keeping my end of the bargain, that I'm going to do the things to help her get to where she wanted to be. She did the work of where I identified the gaps and things that we needed to work on. She dove into those. And then as that promotion period came around, she got her promotion as expected.
Sounds like a great example of a sponsorship. So let's say like magic wand, you're back at, you're at Adobe during your period and you had some more power. I know that was, it sounds like a crazy time to be at Adobe because, you know, transitioning to SaaS like that. I would love to read some more stories about that time. So all the crazy stuff going on and you recognize, you know, CTO, VP of engineering that there weren't enough sponsorship opportunities. What are some things that you think you could have done? And obviously hindsight's 2020, this is no judgment on anyone there now, but what do you think you could have done to make sponsorship opportunities happen more often?
Well, which side of the equation are we talking about? Me sponsoring people or getting people to sponsor me?
Let's say you are, in this hypothetical, you are the person that would be doing the sponsored or rather be control of your directors of engineering and VPs of engineering that might be doing the sponsors.
You're absolutely right. Hindsight is definitely 2020. I was probably a little too focused on the near-term issues there. But if I were to go back and I could change anything, it would definitely be, one, talking to my directs more about sponsorship and that whole difference between sponsorship and mentorship, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of my coaching skewed way more towards the mentorship and not enough on sponsorship. And really tying the whole idea of sponsorship to how does this help the business? Because I think that's what's missing in a lot of these D&I conversations is we know that diversity and inclusion is important and we know that it's the right thing to do and it's a good thing to do, but very rarely do we tie it back to sort of the economic outcomes for a business. Why is a diverse team more useful in product development? How does that actually impact things? And I think if we all as leaders sort of stood back and thought about that. For example, if you're building a consumer-oriented product, you have more than one type of consumer. They're not all white males. You have women, you have people of color, and they all have various levels of economic ability that they can apply to your product. So if you're not reaching out to them in a way that resonates, they're going to ignore your product and lean towards somebody else who's really talking to them. That is the most basic form of tying it back to the business and sort of doing the Jerry Maguire show me the money thing that you could possibly do. And I think if we looked at it through that lens, we would have very different outcomes as opposed to what I think happens today is you almost get beat up with diversity and inclusion to a degree. It's like, you're not doing enough to hire diverse people, which just diverse people is such a weird phrase.
Right. Diverse compared to what?
Exactly. Or you're not doing enough to make this an inclusive environment. And at some point, I've literally seen some leaders' eyes glaze over because they want to do the right thing, but at the same time, they're dealing with, I got to work on this next round of funding. I've got the board beating up on me because I'm not hitting some particular metric. And then I've got my employees beating up on me, all this D&I stuff. And at some point, you know, they pick what's the thing that they can drop on the floor, and it usually is D&I. And I think a lot of that comes from they're not getting strong enough arguments to really put the emphasis in that area compared to all the other things that they're dealing with. And, you know, to some degree, that's reasonable. A perfect example that I've seen is in enterprise open source companies, and I've been in a few of them now, where you have a solutions engineering or a customer success function, and that whole subsection of engineering is predominantly driven by white males. But they also have a very specific mandate about getting a certain number of customers, getting a certain amount of revenue in the door, because that's more easily monetizable than building product. So if their incentive is, we've got to get a bunch of customers, we have to sign them up for support plans, we have to sign them up for, you know, custom development contracts, they're motivated by moving very quickly and getting those contracts satisfied. So if they reach out to the network of people they know that they've worked with before, and they all happen to be white males, can you really be mad at them for not hitting D&I targets? Because they have a competing target that they're working, which is money. And that's where I think that we sometimes do ourselves a disservice when we sort of paint everything with one brush and say that someone's doing bad because they're not, you know, addressing this need, but we're sort of neglecting the fact that they have a probably more pressing need in terms of, we have to hit our numbers, and I don't know how I'm going to address the D&I need and the numbers need at the same time, and the numbers one affects my livelihood. So guess what gets dropped?
Yep. It's not surprising. So what I'm hearing is you're advocating for a more, let's align the numbers with the D&I and make the case for how D&I impacts the bottom line, which frankly, I think there's, like, you know, as far as you look at the numbers, progress, at least on diversity, at least in tech, hasn't really improved that much. Would you agree with that in the last, let's say, 10 years?
I totally agree with that. And I actually talked about this once, I believe, at QCon in San Francisco, that you realistically can't expect for mid to large size companies, the numbers are going to change that dramatically. You would literally have to fire half the people to rehire, you know, people of color, women, to make the numbers change in any significant fashion. So I think that's one of those areas where we have to be careful about what we're using to measure progress, because some things just aren't going to happen or aren't going to happen in any meaningful way. And people will continue to be dissatisfied. Startups is a different story. More likely that you're able to affect those numbers, but I'm pretty sure that the numbers at Adobe aren't that different from when I was there. They've had a little bit of an increase, but still single digits, right? And that's going to be true of most large companies. So the real question is, you know, is that the right metric? Is it really the number of people of a particular category that we should be measuring? Or is it some form of outcome based on changing the makeup of a company? That's probably more where we need to start doing some investigation.
I love setting good key results, as I feel like one of my favorite things. It's like the hardest problem sometimes when you find the right one, like unlocks so much creativity. So I've seen you share some Marty Kagan articles, so I know you at least care a little bit about goal setting. What do you think is the right key result for this?
Oh, I'm still trying to find it myself. I've been definitely doing some thinking on that. And again, it's such a complex topic that trying to narrow it down to, you know, a handful of key results is still kind of squishy. So I don't have a really good answer for that right now, but I'm going to keep pushing on until I find something.
I know some numbers that feel fairly unsatisfying. Like, I've seen people do like percentage of new hires that are underrepresented, which seems okay. Then you look at the number of like moving down the funnel. So like how many your junior engineer numbers change, but your senior engineer's numbers don't change. So that feels like, you know, we set a goal to have more on-time package deliveries, but we actually just like don't deliver some packages because they don't count against our metrics.
And in that case, you know, that's a great example, but I would take it one step further. It's like, well, what percentage of the underrepresented minorities that you hire are still there 1 year out, 3 years out, 5 years out? Because that really measures the inclusion aspect of it. It's real easy to get them in the door, but it's another thing to make them feel welcome, wanted, part of the company, and productive. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's in the 1 to 2 year range a huge drop off of a lot of those underrepresented minorities that you brought in the door because inclusion isn't being tackled.
So when we think about, so most of our listeners are going to be managing smallish teams, you know, two or three teams. So just statistically, even if they're doing a good job, they're going to be few underrepresented minority folks, very few Black folks on their team. So they might have one or two Black folks on a team of 10 to 20. So if we're thinking about how to take their unique situation in account, actually let's back up. So you, in one of your talks, I saw you talked about how you felt kind of otherized growing up as someone who's really smart and also Black in your upbringing. And could you share the impact that kind of struggle had on how things went in your career and how you thought about managing other folks that might have had similar experiences?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, one of the first things that a lot of people don't understand is that even as a minority, we're not homogenous, right? There's people talk about Black people as if we're just like one continent full of exactly the same type of people. And the reality is that my parents are from the West Indies and I'm a first generation American. And my experience is completely different than, say, someone who came from the South. Like Southern Blacks and Caribbean Blacks are completely different. And then we're both completely different, say, from true Africans, like Nigerians, South Africans, completely different level of Black and different experiences. So I think the first thing is we're not all the same. We don't have the same point of view. We don't have the same religious beliefs. We don't have the same political beliefs. You know, I ask people to think, like, how is that any different than white people? Like, you all come from different locations. You have different beliefs. Like, we're the same in that regard. And it's kind of upsetting at times that people don't realize that at that level, we're fundamentally the same. And we, especially as Black people, have to do so much to fit in, and they don't realize how exhausting that is. So I'm sure you're familiar with code switching. That's the main thing that I had to learn growing up. And it wasn't even a term I was familiar with until I was much older, that that's what I was actually doing. But trying to fit in, you know, and I went to school in a predominantly white neighborhood and a Catholic school. So I was surrounded by white people a lot, and it wasn't that hard after a while, but it wore on me because I go to school and I'm acting one way. Then I come back to my neighborhood and I'm surrounded by Black people. I'm now switching and acting a different way. I'm doing that for the majority of my life. And, you know, it's hurtful to, in some respects, when your own people are like, well, you're trying to be like those people. I'm like, no, I'm just trying to be me, but I kind of have to do this to fit in. And that's taken all sorts of weird turns where, like, I've had people that I worked with, some who are actually my managers, make comments to me about, well, you're practically a white guy. And I'm like, okay, that's ridiculous. Because one, if you were in my shoes, you would never say that I was practically a white guy. A cop pulls me over, I'm definitely not a white guy. But it's sort of like the, what do you do? Because I can't say anything in that situation because that's my boss. And I just start to joke, haha, and, you know, shrug it off. And then on the other hand, if I'm out with a lot of Black people, maybe I haven't switched all the way and I'm maybe speaking very proper English and I haven't gone back to talking in a looser fashion. And then they say, well, you're acting white. So you really can't win. And I think for a lot of people, that one is just unfair. And it's, you know, difficult to sort of deal with this dual identity sometimes to just cope in the world. Like, you know, we hear a lot of people say, oh, you should be able to bring your true self to work. Yeah, that's great to say. It's not reality. Like, I've seen people try to bring their true selves to work and then get shunned for doing exactly that. So, yeah, having to live in that sort of dual mode for the majority of my life, been stressful. It's, you know, had me doubting, like, am I Black enough? Am I professional enough? Am I this enough for many, many years? And I've learned to deal with it to some degree, but it is something that's sort of in my face every single day.
So it's like a constant, like, low level amount of cognitive processing you have to do to kind of know what switching your, you know, what mode are you in? What do you need to communicate? It's kind of like wearing ankle weights. It's not, maybe it also makes you a little stronger. Like you're at least aware of those things, which I think having to switch, awareness is kind of a superpower sometimes as a manager. Do you think it's given you any advantages?
It's definitely helped me be a little bit more relatable. Like, I can having to have to make those changes to adapt in so many different situations, then I can sort of turn that around when I am in these different situations and adapt to people and try to make them feel more comfortable. So that's definitely been helpful. Definitely improved my listening, because in doing all that code switching, you are listening for cues a lot of times. You're looking to see where you can cut into a conversation or how you should do it or what people are expecting here. So it's definitely sort of giving you heightened senses in a lot of different situations. But yeah, definitely, I hadn't heard the ankle weight analogy before. That's actually pretty good. It's like something you have to do. And when you take that ankle weight off, you know, things seem so much easier, but it feels like I have it on way more often than I have it off.
I love what you said about bring your true self to work, because I think when I hear people say that, I think they mostly mean well. It's like, we don't want people to be different, but I also struggle with so I'm autistic, and I know that, for example, I have to go out of my way to look people in the eyes, because if I don't, they think that I'm not listening to them, and I am. I just that's not how I think when I'm processing someone. I don't know where I was going with that. That's my ankle weights, I guess.
We all have them.
Yeah, I think so. So the true self is I think it is not okay. I think it's okay for me to take the, I need to look people in the eyes. I think it would be tough for everyone I interacted with to be like, oh, that's just Wes. He doesn't look people in the eyes. I think that's a sort of thing that I could do. So I think my true self is probably not doing that, but I'm okay with that. I'm wondering what's the right, for you, is, neighborhood you growing up, or is Catholic school you, your true self? I'm not really sure.
It's probably somewhere in between, to be honest. Because that early on, I mean, pretty much from first grade through eighth, I was, in this Catholic school. So a lot of my early days were shaped by a lot of people that didn't look like me. And I'm okay with that. It's just that so many people seem to not be okay with it, that I'm not what they expect when they say a black man who was born in Brooklyn, New York. They have the stereotypical picture of, the hip hop fiend. I love hip hop, but I didn't really dress a lot with baggy jeans and Timberland boots and all that other stuff, because that wasn't me. But I totally identify with it, because that's, the world that was around me when I wasn't in school. But even simpler things, I think, when we talk about bringing your true self to work, it was a few years ago that I realized that something as simple as shaving my head was something that I was doing to fit in. You'll hear from a lot of black people that they always get a lot of attention if they wear a natural hairstyle to work, where some people are told they can't do it or they have to change it or what have you, or even in some situations in some schools, kids getting their dreadlocks cut off because that's not up to code or whatever. And it's not like I had a big ass afro or anything like that, but I was kind of conscious. I'm like, you know what? I shave my head. It's low maintenance. Nobody pays attention. I'm like, yeah, am I really doing that because it's low maintenance, or is it because then I look a little bit more acceptable in the environments that I'm in, because no one's going to comment about my hair? It's like removing all the things that people could pick apart about me. Have I been doing this all along to better fit in?
I think almost certainly, right? We as humans, that's we are more scared of standing out sometimes and being wrong. I think the coronavirus thing, whatever you think of it, this is the beginning of March. People are kind of starting to figure out, hey, this might be a thing. That's not the flu. I think for a while it was I don't want to be the weirdo that's freaked out about this, was kind of the driving characteristic.
Yep, absolutely.
So we've got these folks on our team that are not homogenous. This is a black person. I don't know if they're first gen. So maybe step one is I need to get to know this person because their experience might be different. What are some other, and maybe I know that maybe they've got a little low level cognitive stress because they're code switching to be in this environment. What are some other things that I should keep in mind when I'm trying to not screw up my inclusion on my small team?
I think the biggest thing yet, and simplest in some respects, but also seems to be the hardest thing, is to literally treat them like you would treat anyone else. We are probably so attuned to being different in so many situations that all we're really looking for is to be treated like everybody else. I see some very well-meaning people who are trying to be allies, try to support people who are in an underrepresented minority, but to the point where it becomes obvious and blatant. And that makes people uncomfortable. It's like, okay, why are you singling me out or putting the spotlight on me? I just want to do my work, or I just want to be normal. And I think that's the thing I would advise all leaders to. Great that you want to help out and that you want to try to make things more equitable, but be careful of how far you go, because in your zeal to do something that's helpful and good-hearted for other folks, you're actually probably making it worse in a lot of situations. So really think about if I'm giving projects out to folks on the team, that the way I'm doing it for the Black person is the same as I do it for the white person. It's like I'm doing things based on a more equitable scale of, hey, you're at this particular level, you should be able to handle a project of this level, and I trust you to do it, versus trying to shift the work around to sort of the expected approaches of, I'll give the good projects to these five people because they pattern match against what I think are good software engineers, and I'll give the rest of these projects to these people because they don't pattern match. That's really the thing you should be looking for, more so than doing anything special because of a person's gender or ethnicity. It's, how do I treat them all roughly the same?
Do you have any examples where someone you think was meaning well? Because I think this is, it's a dangerous trap, all right? Because people that are meaning well are usually not the most self-reflective of people. You know, when we're like on our crusade, feeling good about the thing we do, it's probably the time where we're, at least I am at my least self-reflective because I'm feeling good about myself. What are some times you've seen that happen?
I've definitely seen it happen. I don't want to get too specific to call people out. Yeah, but I think there's definitely been a tendency to pull underrepresented minorities into D&I efforts, thinking that, well, they're the best ones to help us solve some of these problems, or they'll speak about them at conferences. And a lot of the times, they're the last people who want to do this stuff because it's additional labor. It's, you know, stuff that they would literally say, I have a hard enough time just doing my own job. Now I have to do this additional work, and I feel compelled to do it. So definitely resist that urge to sort of pull them into this extra stuff, because it does put the spotlight on them, for one, and it is creating additional stress because now they feel compelled to do great work at their regular job and this additional work at the same time. Putting people up on mini pedestals, sort of like highlighting the, hey, you know, we have this great female engineer X, or we have this great Black engineer. That's nice, but make sure that people like that sort of attention. A lot of people don't like public praise. They actually get very self-conscious about that. So while you're doing it more to say, hey, we're, you know, really taking this seriously, and we're trying to, you know, promote more inclusion, you're making that person feel really uncomfortable as part of doing it. The other is, again, with the allocation of work, if you're doing something out of the ordinary for one person, the rest of the team is sort of looking at that. So you have to think about, this is a team dynamic that you're playing with. And if somebody is either seen as being favored or coddled or anything like that, then the rest of the team might start having ill feelings towards them or treating them differently and then almost excluding them. And I've definitely seen that situation where, again, giving somebody a great project, great, but don't do it to, in such an obvious way that it's because they're other. And that's the thing that's more damaging than anything else I've seen so far, because who's going to say no to taking on a great project if it's going to help them with their career? But at the same time, if the result of that is I'm an outcast from the rest of my team because of it, was it really worth it?
Or even like you give someone more junior project that they needed to be more senior. Have you done them a favor if they struggle on what was a hard project? So this might be a dumb question. I'm going to ask it anyway. So you see a D&I initiative, and it's just like two white guys on the D&I initiative. Is that bad? Is that good? Is that like impossible to judge without context?
It's impossible to judge without context. I think a few years ago, I might have said, what are you crazy? But now I would say, yeah, it's impossible to judge without context because, you know, similar to what I've been saying about pulling the underrepresented minorities into the mix to solve the D&I problems, in a lot of ways, it really is, for, especially in tech, a problem that white men do have to solve and step up a lot more to resolve some of those problems. So in some cases, I could actually see the two white guys on the D&I initiative being a good thing, you know, within limits. It could be completely poor judgment because, like, oh, you know, they could be going in with the white savior complex, like, we can solve this all by ourselves. So you definitely need the context. I couldn't just judge it based on that. I would definitely feel more comfortable if I saw more than two people and a mix of people that were involved. But I've also seen efforts like that with that composition completely fail. So it's really hard to tell.
I'm thinking, if 70% of your team is white men in tech, and we're trying to not overload certain folks with roles that are, you know, often unpaid, they're not career promoting. So your heuristic there is, what are their motivations? It sounded like kind of the white savior complex would be, is that a motivation fail, or is that some other type of fail?
Mostly a motivation fail, because I think a lot of folks, unfortunately, have that savior complex. Like, they feel, you know, they want to be the hero. They want to come in and save the day. And we don't need saving. We just need being treated right. And those are two different things. So definitely the motivation is one thing, and education. Like, it's surprising how many people dive into D&I efforts without doing the slightest bit of research, slightest bit of understanding. You know, you don't have to be a D&I expert, but read a book, right? Like, read a history book. Like, if you really want to tackle these problems, understand that most of these companies are US-based companies. So understand the basics of systemic racism in the country, because that's what's being brought in to a lot of these work situations. So if somebody told me they read, you know, two or three books on the history of racism in the US, I'd be like, okay, at least you started with the basics and, you know, might have some inkling of an understanding of what's going to be involved here. If you've done more than that, fantastic. But, you know, don't just jump in saying, this was wrong, I'm going to fix it, and you have no foundation to build off of to do that.
So if you see someone who is taking in historical context, doing your research, that would be a heuristic that you think it's more likely to be successful coming from a good place.
Definitely. And especially if they then go to the next step, say, hey, I don't know a lot about this, I should probably bring in an expert. You know, see, there are tons of people doing D&I work that actually have done the research and can help companies. So even if you just went out for a consultation and didn't hire them, you know, fully to come into your company and institute the program, that alone is at least a step in the right direction.
That makes sense. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some practical systems. You're a systems guy. I read your increment article on building teams, and it was all systems. You start with the small system that work. That my summary of it is every problem, it was you started with a small system and then expanded from it, which, like, I dig it. So what is the system that you would recommend when it comes to career pathing, promotions, salary bands as we grow our team?
You know, the first thing, start with your career path, your career ladders. That's more often than not the area that I see is either completely neglected or was started but never evolved over time. So look at it as not just something internal for your folks, but even something external as a recruiting mechanism, especially to pull in underrepresented minorities. Because if you're looking at it from our perspective, we're going to go to your company website. We're going to look at everything about you, your product, your teams, whatever. But we also want to know, you know, what's the future like for me here? If I don't see it on your website, it's definitely going to be something we're going to ask about during the interview. Like, all right, how do I, if I come in as an entry-level engineer, how do I move up to a senior engineer? Is there a complete technical path for me, or is there a ceiling? And at some point I have to move over to management. If you can't answer those questions for them, you're losing them, because they're probably going to say, oh, this is going to be like every other company where I'm just going to work and work and work and there's no growth for me here. So you want to be able to lay that out and really explain to folks not just what the actual levels are, but what's really required to make the transition from level to level. Is it just an arbitrary list of checklist items, or is it demonstrating growth and capability in various areas that actually guarantee promotion? And being able to clearly articulate that and convincingly articulate that is going to make a huge amount of difference. You then, with that, having that career ladder, definitely look at your recruiting pipeline and your interviewing process. The number one fail that I've seen in a lot of places is having an ad hoc or semi-rigid process around interviewing, where interviewers are coming in and don't know who they're interviewing, don't know what the position is, don't know what they should be asking. That just shows poor preparation on the company side and affects the experience that a candidate's going to have. So make sure you actually have that tight. I'm not going to say that there are things that everyone should be doing, because every company is different, but things like how you evaluate the candidate should be something that's a lot more quantitative than qualitative. You have to have some sort of scoring mechanism so you can compare candidates on a relatively even basis, and not just leave it up to the, oh yeah, I like this person, I like their answer because it resembled mine, versus here's how we're measuring them and how we're going to grade these things moving forward. getting that nailed and making sure that everybody involved in the interview understands the process, understands what's expected of them, and understands how their input's going to feed into the overall decision process is key. Main thing on the hiring manager side is you have to be involved. Like, even if you have a recruiter, some cases, places are small, they don't have a recruiter. Like, you have to really be involved in the process. When I was at Heptio, I was literally the recruiter for like the first 6 to 8 months until we hired a recruiter. And even then, I was still pretty much the first line of contact most engineers had. I did the majority of the screening. I decided who moved forward. I was involved in sourcing, which if you're going to improve diversity, you have to be involved in the sourcing and not just leave it up to, we're going to go to the usual sources and try to pull people in or throw up an application online and just expect that you're somehow going to get a diverse mix of candidates. You really have to go to where people are. So build your networks on Twitter, reach out to HBCUs, reach out to the coding boot camps and try to pull those people in. And what you feed into the beginning of your process is going to impact what comes out of your process. Those are definitely the big things that I would advise everybody to focus on.
So what I heard there is have a well-defined career path, because if you don't, underrepresented, everyone, but especially underrepresented folks are going to see that as a sign that it's going to be a struggle for them to advance. I heard that we need defined hiring process, both externally to the candidate, that you can communicate what the steps are, and then internally what the decision process is for that. And are you kind of a rubrics advocate when it comes to that quantitative decision-making? What kind of tools do you use?
I've played with rubrics. They're not the only solution, but they're actually very good.
What are some other solutions that you like?
Most of the time, I tailor it to the organization rather than pick it. So like, for example, at Heptio, we didn't use rubrics per se, but we definitely had a multi-pronged approach to identifying whether a candidate was going to be a good fit for us, which was a mix of the values interview, which we actually tried to do earlier in the process than later for very good reasons. And I'll get into that in a bit. A skills exercise, which we did the take-home thing, which worked really well for what we were doing. I've seen it not work particularly well in other companies, but we found one simple flaw that we addressed with the skills exercise. So at first we, decided that somebody should get the exercise, go off and get it. Definitely men tend to jump into it and get us the exercises back relatively quickly. With a lot of the women that I explicitly recruited, I noticed a huge drop off right after they got the skills exercise. And I started thinking about why exactly might that be, because I knew they were capable of doing it. And I think it was sort of this exhaustion of doing skills exercises since everybody was asking for that and not knowing what's coming next. So the major change I made was when I handed that out, said, hey, just so you know, here's what's next in the interview process. You're going to go off and do this. When you send it back to us, you'll have an interview with an engineer to walk through your solution, talk about exactly, what the trade-offs were that you made and maybe make some extensions to it. And in parallel, you're going to have the values exercise as well as another technical discussion, which will literally just be a discussion talking about design choices or technology or what have you. And those three things together will determine whether you move on to an on-site. And once people actually understood very clearly, here's what's going to happen next, I saw an uptick in getting a lot more of those skills exercise returned. So little things like that gave insights into how we could iterate and improve our overall interviewing process and move things forward.
I love that. So you started communicating, you're going to do this, and then we're going to talk about it. And you saw your completion rate skyrocket for your female candidates. That's brilliant. I think take-homes they're a great tool, but it's easy to misuse that tool. I think the biggest mistake I see is people having take-homes. They're like, oh, this will probably take 3 hours. And then you ask their candidates, and like they all spent 9 hours on it to get something that's good.
That is exactly what happens. We would say, please don't spend more than 4 hours on this. If you do, you can stop. And without fail, because people want to do really well, they would end up taking over a period of 2 weeks, 8 or 9 hours on it. And we're like, well, didn't need to go that far. So that's still sort of the challenge with take-home exercises. You don't want to make them too big. You don't want to make them too small. But you also can't really control how much time people are going to spend on it unless you bound it. In some way, it's challenging.
I'm an advocate for strict time limits, not calendar time limits, but like I will send you this at time X, you will send it at time X plus Y, which is downsides of that are you can make people stressed out. Like, clocks suck. Most people don't actually work under a clock. Like, we all have, you know, the 40-ish hours a week clock. So we do, but it's like macro, not micro. So it can stress people out. It's really easy to miscalibrate an exercise where, oh man, the first 10 people all failed at it because, oh, turns out engineering, it's hard to estimate how long things take. It's easy to mess up. My counterpoints on those is, like, the alternative is people who have more time have an advantage. So my heuristic is, like, do you want someone who, if you have a woman who is currently employed, they're a single mother, they have all the caretaking responsibilities, and they're competing against someone who is, you know, a 20-year-old dude outside of right out of college who is probably going to be replacing video game time. One of those people is going to have more time to invest. That's my quick pitch for why time limits are actually good if you get them right. What do you think about that?
I intellectually agree, and yet I also get, like, we're engineers. Any one of these situations, we can come up with a counterpoint to the counterpoint to the counterpoint, you know, because I could say, yeah, time limits are great. And especially for that single mother who has all the caretaker responsibilities, you can shift that portion of the interview either to the on-site or a virtual on-site. So yeah, you do have that control time, but now you're right back into the time pressure and people maybe not working best with, like, somebody over their shoulder while they're doing it. So it's like, there are all these variables that you have to account for. But that said, you don't want to throw out the benefit of doing that sort of skills assessment. Like, you're hiring somebody to be an engineer, you need to get some signal as to whether or not they can do the job you're hiring them for. Now, if you're dealing with a more senior candidate, you know, I've seen people say, well, we're not going to make you jump through the hoops and do coding exercises based on the jobs you've done before. Maybe you're fortunate enough to have a GitHub profile. We can look at that stuff. But that's where you now get into inconsistencies, because there are people who can't put their code on GitHub or have gotten a senior title, you know, for other reasons. How do you normalize things so that people are being treated fairly? So it's still a complex topic, but I do agree that some form of time limit is required for the reasons you stated. It's just trying to figure out what's the best approach and how do you scale the challenge to that time limit in a way that's going to be beneficial to everyone.
We mostly have trade-offs. That's what we get to deal with. And we can spend time and get higher quality, but ultimately there's still trade-offs. There's one point in your article on pay bands that I want to ask about. So if I recall correctly, you recommend early stage startups, when they're first building their pay bands and laddering, to have overlapping pay bands, where, like, one level would have a pay band that would overlap with the subsequent level. I think I've heard other people describe the opposite. So I'm interested in hearing why would you want overlapping pay bands versus non-overlapping?
A lot of the reason has to do, especially with earlier stage startups, is that when you're first working on your career ladders, you're not going to get it right. So let's make sure everybody understands that up front. You're going to get it completely wrong. But what you want to do is set up a level of expectation that the promotion action is not directly tied to compensation. I mean, historically, that's the way things have been. And people sort of expect, well, if I want to get to this next level and get more money, I have to get a promotion. And I think that's mixing incentives in a really bad way. You know, you want to have the career growth ladder really be more about mastery and achieving certain skills and abilities over time that you're then rewarded by. That's a recognition thing, right? You're like, we recognize that you've grown as an engineer, that you've been mentoring other people, and that's really what the promotion's about. And you want to decouple compensation from that, because you can be improving as an engineer to the point where, like, yeah, you should be rewarded for that. And that should be a financial reward, but you don't want to hit this level of, I can only get so many financial rewards until I now hit the promotion buffer. So the idea of overlapping is saying, leave some room so that if somebody's been doing really good work, but they haven't really been hitting those notes in terms of moving up the ladder, you can still reward them in one way, but use that moment to say, all right, before you move up to senior, these are sort of the behaviors we want to see from you. These are the sort of outcomes we want to get from you before you get moved up there. But you don't hit that roadblock of, I can't give you more money because you're not within the pay band, even though you probably deserve it. And that's really the rationale for the overlapping. It's to give you some more wiggle room to deal with those two things separately and not have frustrated people thinking that I should get more money or I've been doing more work and I can't do it because they're saying I'm not ready for promotion. That's usually the friction that I've seen over and over again.
So maybe the advice I've heard is more about at some level of scale when you really dialed in that sort of thing, maybe then, because the trade-offs in my mind is if I have these, you know, perfect system and they have non-overlapping pay bands, that helps me from shooting myself in the foot and giving people that negotiate harder, push for higher salaries, like relatively more comp because, you know, there are gender differences in ability to negotiate and ability to not be retaliated against for negotiating. So I do worry about my ability to get that right. But is that like the scale of your company? Do you think that's the primary difference for that advice?
I think that it can apply at various scales. And in fact, in Adobe, we did have the overlapping bands, even in the larger companies. It's really more how many different controls do you have to work with in order to reward people? Because at a smaller scale, you're not going to do what a lot of larger companies do in terms of rebalancing the pay scales as frequently. You know, they might say, hey, you know, we're looking at the industry averages and, you know, this level is, you know, completely under what the rest of the industry is doing. So we're now going to shift everybody up. Not everybody is going to be in a position where they can do that and sort of basically pay out a bunch of folks to rebalance them at a new level all the time. So at least with the overlapping scales, you're giving yourself some more runway at the earlier stages. You can continue that on as you scale up. But usually if you scale up, that means one, you're successful and you have other tools that you can use like stock at, you know, spot bonuses that are sizable to make up for some of those differences.
So last question. So you're on the market. So a lot of folks are vying for your attention right now. And by the time this airs, you might be off the market again. But if someone's listening and they're like, I need a VP of engineering who's done this stuff. What are you looking for in your next role that you'd be really excited about?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question because it's probably the most frequent question I've had over the past few weeks. People asking, what am I looking for? And it's not what a lot of people think. I'm not very prescriptive about, you know, I want to work on this particular technology or this size company. Like all of that's frankly a little bit irrelevant. In fact, if anyone's looked at my history, I've never really worked in the same area over and over again. You know, I try to move from consumer to enterprise, front end, back end, mobile, because I'm just interested in technology in a lot of different ways. But what it really comes down to for me are three major things. One are people. We spend the majority of our waking lives working with other people. So the people I work with kind of matter. I, you know, want to feel that they're good people overall. We share values and that I can collaborate with them because that's what I'm going to spend the majority of my time doing. The second is the product. I have to at least have some connection to the product, whether it's something that I feel I would use myself or I can see why this is valuable to people, why they would pay money to have this product in their life to solve a particular problem. Like I have to get that. It can't be sort of the, you know, hey, I had this great idea and I think it should exist, but
optimizes ad serving.
Yeah, that's really not going to do it for me, you know? So it's probably going to skew more towards something in the productivity space or a developer tool space, you know, something that someone has to use to get their job done because that sort of intrinsic value to me leads to good business outcomes versus just throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks. And then the final thing is, this probably skews me more towards the small and medium-sized companies. I want to feel like I have an impact on the company itself. I very frequently tell people that to me, hacking people is greater than hacking code, and it's a lot harder than hacking code. And I want to do that, like helping to build the company, build the culture of the company through the engineering function specifically. But in general, I want to be part of that executive team and really shape what the company is going to be. Those are like my big three items. And if any company can satisfy those three things the most, they win.
So if I'm someone advocating for my company, I need a company with good people, important product, and we're making an we have a room for an engineering leader to make a big impact. And that's your spot.
That is very well put. Exactly it.
My guest today has been Kevin Stewart. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams. Thanks again to Kevin for sharing his experience with us. Here are a couple of takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, our metrics may undermine our diversity and inclusion efforts. It is impossible to serve two goals equally. One is going to subsume the other. If we think of hiring fast and shipping product as different from diversity, diversity is always going to be second or third fiddle. Instead, framing diversity as an input that will allow us to ship product faster through more effective teams, then we actually have a fighting chance. Even if we're just measuring demographic breakdown of hires, that's inadequate. Retention is what shows inclusion. So we need to be measuring demographics and diversity metrics at multiple stages in the career pipeline. It's also important to consider not setting unrealistic goals. So setting a goal like, my engineering team should look like America. Well, if it currently is like most engineering teams, that would require firing half the team to replace with minorities, and that's probably not realistic. So Kevin encourages us to consider setting unrealistic goals relative to where we are today. Number two, code switching places an invisible burden on underrepresented folks. Code switching is when we speak or act differently in one place than we would in another place. A simple example would be, you know, you don't curse around your grandma. That's a pretty easy code switch. More complex code switches are completely changing the types of words you use, your pronunciation. So this is more common in underrepresented groups. Kevin questions the concept of bringing your true self to work. Not really. We kind of bring our professional selves to work. And in Kevin's situation, he has asked himself the question, am I black enough versus am I professional enough, which is a challenge. All of this kind of constant low-level processing is like wearing ankle weights. It's mentally hard. So we need to be aware of that burden. Number three, there's a difference between champion underrepresented groups and tokenizing them. Tokenizing would be praising someone based on their identity versus what we should be doing is praising someone based on their work. We can also be accidentally hurtful by adding extra burden on underrepresented groups, assuming they will lead D&I efforts. That's additional label for them that is not necessarily promotable. There's also lots of individual variants here. So the important point is to talk to individuals and understand their stances about doing this additional work. It's also important to understand how someone wants to be praised in public or private. These are basic management things, but they're especially important when working with underrepresented groups. Thanks again to Kevin for coming on the show. Now, I want to hear from you. If you have any questions about growing a remote team, please email me at wes@woventeams.com. I read every email personally, and I'm excited to help you work on your problems. Until next week, keep on scaling.